You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. A26 on a Friday. Mike McNamara with you, and joined by Ken Rogers. Whenever we talk about Vietnam, Ken, I feel the need to play like some kind of hard rock and roll music. Is that a is that the way it goes?
Yeah.
The well, that's kind of a funny way to start this. The culture of I guess you. That's just the way the culture was, yes? Hard rock and roll music, young guys out of high school and heading over to Vietnam. And that's kind of, you guys have always enjoyed kind of the aura of kind of badasses and bad boys. Yes, no?
Well, I think, you know, it was something that maybe we didn't want, but we got. And so we took advantage of it when it was suited, you know, when it suited me, but it also sometimes, you know, I think it also contributed to the attitude that among the general population that we were baby killers and all of that kind of stuff. Right. So I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, we grew up on, you know, the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and of course in Vietnam it just wasn't hard rock. I mean, we listened to that, but we also listened to a lot of soul music and you know, because there were a lot of African American guys in the Marine Corps, and so we listened to Aretha Franklin and Otis Redding and those kind of guys too.
Yeah, there wasn't. Everybody didn't have a radio with their own music on it at that point in time, did they?
Absolutely not. You could listen to Armed Forces Radio. You could listen to Hanoi Hannah. Or if you were lucky, you had a battery operated record player. So,
a battery-operated LP or 45 record player that I guess you rotated the records on. Hopefully they stayed out of the sun and didn't warp.
Or they didn't get too wet and get moldy and or get broken.
or scratched. Let me tell you, a huge technological advancement, but I don't think it came to about 1971 or 2. Was a little lever that lifted the needle up on your record so you could like move it between songs. Before that, you had to go in with your hand.
That's right.
And that was that was a dicey proposition because that's when you heard the and everybody just
that's
looked
right.
like you just scratched the record.
Right.
back in the day.
Yes, sir.
You know what? Interesting. Last week, a guy sent a message out on LinkedIn, and he said, "I've been to over, you know, I retired from the Marine Corps. I've been to over, I want to say it was over 20 interviews, and I can't get hired. Is it me? What am I doing wrong? You know, they say they want to hire veterans, but I'm really struggling." And so I made a comment to the effect that everybody says they want to hire you, but in fact, that's not true. That is seldom true. I was warned before I got out when I pinged a few of my friends that were already out, don't say anything about going to Iraq or Afghanistan. Certainly don't tell them you were in the infantry, and stay away from any discussion about post-traumatic stress. Act like you don't even know what it is, because they don't know us, and they see what they see in the news, and they are probably quite rightly very scared, terrified, intimidated, pick a word, of you. Now that's low 50 years later. After Vietnam, and guys still fight that stigma of workplace violence, you're going to snap, all of that. You guys came home, and since you were not greeted as the, you know, with heroes, parades, and ticker tape, you guys probably, truth be told, the first generation of American warriors to feel that.
Yeah, that's probably true. I certainly didn't tell anybody about it. I worked in places for years, and people never knew I'd even been in the military. But you know, people say they want to hire veterans, but I think what they're really looking for is a veteran that is better than everybody else and fits in with what they want. So, I'm not sure that is the top criteria. If I was hiring some people, if that was the top criteria that I'd be looking for, as an employer, it certainly would make a difference. But if I had 3 applicants in a job, and one of them that was not a veteran, had a better attitude, had more experience, was better trained, I would probably hire that person.
And you would have no regard for their service?
Oh, I would, but it's like it may not be the determining factor if somebody gets a job. I think people, I've gone nuclear in the workplace more than once, and I think of my employers that had known that that I was carrying that around with me. I think they may have been hesitant to hire me in the first place because it sure upset them after I went off.
After you snapped.
Yeah.
So. Well, no, I thought it was I was surprised. First of all, that when those guys came back, when and I didn't get that from one guy either. I got that from multiple guys, and they're good, guys, qualified guys. One was in the CBRN field, so the NBC field, and he said, "Look, I've done things all over the world, and I lose out. I'm the runner up all the time to some local bozo." Who isn't nearly as qualified. And I at first I thought it was, the interview, blah, blah, blah. He said, but it's happened to me too many times. He said, just be leery of the fact that they say they want to hire veterans, but they're very, 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 skittish about it. And so, mind your P's and Q's and understate, all of everything that you did, to include your combat time. Do not shy away from the quote was, stay away from that conversation. Diminish it as much as you
can. I don't know.
That just surprised me.
I don't know what to think about that. I'd have to think about it a lot before I could really come up with an opinion about it. But, In my case, and I think a lot of guys that I served with, if you weren't going to work for the government where you might get a preference, if you want to go for the post office, work for the post office in 1970 or 69, you got a preference from being a veteran. They didn't care. But if you were going to work for somebody, out there in the private sector, you just did not talk about it at all. But we didn't talk about it with anybody.
Right.
It was just you didn't talk about it. I guess the fact that you're getting these kind of messages to me is very interesting because we hear all of this, hire a veteran, and we're veteran interested, and we want to hire veterans. And then that's not the case. And I wonder if that's runs tandem to this issue of, I'm one of these guys, when somebody tells me thank you for their service, I'm kind of skeptical. Thank you for your service. I'm just a little skeptical. I want to say, well, okay, did you serve? And if not, why?
That's something we normally don't talk about, right?
Yeah.
We don't talk about that because I have so many of my friends I've had this conversation with because – and here's what my friends say, the majority of them. It's not like they mean it, right? It's like this throwaway line. Thank you for your service. Oh, okay. You're welcome. And I don't know. A lot of guys have problems with that kind of as a drive-by throwaway line.
Well, I do, and I'm not going to say that some people don't mean it because, right. You know, I mean, we deal with enough people that some of them are going to mean it. But my point is being that, you know, it might be the proper thing to say we hire veterans, okay, because that's what we're expected to say. But when the push comes to shove, maybe we don't want to because of all the factors that you discuss, we're frightened of you. You scare us. You have done things that we don't know anything about. We don't understand. If we have to deal with it, we don't know how to deal with it because, frankly, we aren't from that milieu.
Interesting. No, I know a lot of guys. I was talking to Mike Musselman about it, and he said I hate it. He said I'd rather people didn't say anything to me. He said because to me it sounds like you just could have said excuse me, but you said thank you for your service. You know, just something that you said. It bothers me. Okay, I'm not your doormat. You don't need to say that bullshit to me.
Yep.
Right.
Don't say it.
Yeah, don't say it. Just say hi, and keep walking.
Yeah.
Keep walking.
Right.
It's interesting. We don't talk about this in public much, but I think all veterans feel it. So here's an email. The title is Things People Say But Don't Mean. Mac, you're touching a pretty raw nerve with me, and these are two things that I think most of us live to experience at one time in our life, post-combat experience. We hire veterans. I think that's a big bunch of bullshit. The only people who hire veterans, in my opinion, are other veterans. They're not afraid of them. They know the language. They're comfortable with the culture, much like your radio show. It's a comfortable place for us. You had Richard Sisk on the other day. He talked about walking around with his resume post-Vietnam and not being able to get hired. And then some guy in the last place he went for the day walked over to him and asked for his resume. Saw that he was a Marine. He was a veteran. I think he said he was a Marine, and he hired him. He said, I think that's pretty much how it works. Other people are afraid. And as far as thank you for your service, if I don't ever hear that again, I'll be happy. It's incredibly different when somebody looks at you, sticks their hand out, looks you in the face, shakes your hand, and says, hey, thank you for your service. But the throwaway line, when they find out you're a veteran, thank you for your service, drives me absolutely crazy. I try to be polite, but it's hard for me sometimes. Enjoyed Ken. I enjoyed the documentary. It's very powerful. My question to Ken is, what's next on the docket for the Rogers Production Company? So, first of all, thoughts on the email. I guess our sentiment. Other veterans hire veterans because they're comfortable with it.
I think that's true. Occasionally, there may be somebody out there that has had veterans working for them and understands that, you know, they bring assets of not blowing up in a crisis, being able to handle pressure, leadership, all those good things you learn in the military. But, you know, like I say, and of course, it was kind of like a forced on us, but I just kept my mouth shut about it and didn't say anything. And as far as the other business, I agree with the email. Occasionally you'll get somebody that shakes your hand, looks you in the eye, and you believe them. But that throwaway line is, I just think, I wish you hadn't said that to me. So.
Yeah, no kidding. And hold on, one more email, and then I want you to answer the last part of his question. Here's the next email. Mac, be careful where you go this morning. We don't talk about that in public. Don't pull the curtain back, but I'm laughing my ass off because I hate that shit too. I think most guys, and girls, if you're a veteran, it's just, you know, it's like you feel violated if you don't, if somebody says it doesn't mean it, because look, when you say thank you for your service as a throwaway line to a guy who lived through Quezon, you know what the response is? Hey, fuck you. Right? Do you understand?
Yeah, pretty much.
Do you understand what we get? Let me just tell you, I wasn't there, okay? But me and my dog Jack, we lived through the documentary, okay? Jack wound up under the bed in the bedroom because there is artillery going off throughout, in the soundtrack throughout the documentary. And after a while, it's like, okay, I got it. Can we turn that shit off for a while? And then you think about 7 months of that. Like, how are you
right.
guys? How are you guys all not clinically insane?
Well, we are. I think. I mean, all you have to do is go to a Quezon veterans reunion, and it's remarkable how much we are alike in that regard. I mean, you can't go through that and not have a profound impression on who you are, what you think about humanity, what you think about existence.
Do you believe in God?
No, I don't believe. I'm not religious at all. I don't believe in any of that. I believe that when you die, you die, and that's it.
Did you go? So, did you believe in God before you went?
Oh, not really. My mother was a Mormon, and so my father was a heathen, and
interesting combination there.
Oh yeah, yeah. So I got it from both sides. You know, my father was hard-headed about life, and so I mean, he counterpunched what she was putting on me in.
Right.
But I think I must have been about 9 or 10, and I just didn't believe in it. It didn't resonate. Well, you know, I think it's got to be an emotional thing, and there was no emotion there. So I was not religious when I got there, but it still was.
Well, I'll tell you what. There's the old there's the old saying. There's no atheists in a foxhole. What did you go through when you were in Quezon? All the different things you saw, the way you saw people get killed, the randomness
right.
of it, that everybody
right.
that everybody struggles to live with. Why right. him, not me? I stand up, he sits down, he gets whacked, I'm alive. And then vice versa, he stood up, I sat down. The seven guys that just drowned on the USS Fitzgerald, you know, why them, not me? Why did some guys make it out and not others? So did you contemplate religion at all while you were there?
Not much. Most of the guys there were, in some regard, religious. I mean, I went to two different services, meetings, none of them during the siege. One of them was after a firefight in June of 1967 off Hill 881 South, where we lost 19 guys. And we went there, and the chaplain explained to us that these guys died for a good cause, and that if I'd had any religion right then, that was it for me. I mean, it just really irritated me that he said that, and it was condescending in the way he did it. And then I went to Christmas services on Hill 881 South in 1967, and we're sitting there singing that Soldier, Sailors, Marines hymn. Or they were, I was, and I didn't know the words to it. And outside, right outside the
Eternal
tent,
Eternal Father?
Yes,
that one?
Yes, yeah, that one. And so right outside the tent where we were having a service, there's an 81-millimeter mortar in place. They got fire mission, and they're shooting off 81 mortars at somebody out there in the dark. And it just struck me as being kind of strange that here we're worshiping the birth of a man that said you turn the other cheek and all of that stuff, and yet we're you know, juxtaposed with that is this, we're out there killing people. So, I mean, I just always, you know, it's like I couldn't get there in between that.
Right.
So.
How does it all make sense?
It doesn't make sense to me. So.
Ken Rogers, you got out of the Marine Corps at what rank?
Corporal.
Vietnam era, and you were an 0311?
Yes, sir.
There you go. 0311 at Khe Sanh, and he and his wife, Betty, have documented the story of Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26 Marines during the Vietnam War, and particularly at Khe Sanh. And by all means, if you have not seen the documentary, Bravo! Exclamation mark! Common Men, Uncommon Valor. Put it on your things. Put it on your list of things to do. And especially if you're a Marine, it's incredible to watch. It's intense too, because the story is intense. The reaction of the guys telling their stories is intense, and it'll move you. But I would tell you, it's well, watch it by yourself. It's awesome. It's awesome. So what's next? Well, first of all, I want to talk about, you went to a funeral yesterday, and, for Marine by the name of Art Jackson, and, he's a Medal of Honor recipient.
On Peleliu.
And yeah. Do you know a fair amount of his story, of his life history?
He has quite a history.
Right. He is an interesting guy. But my question is, he doesn't get promoted, he doesn't get decorated until President Truman decorates him. So that's after April of 45. Peleliu, what, in either 43 or 44?
So no, September and October of 44, maybe 44? Even in November.
Okay, yeah. And then does he stay with the 1st Division and participate in Okinawa, or?
Yeah, he went all the way through Okinawa as a PAR man, and
holy shit.
Yeah, he was on Cape Gloucester, you know, right after the 1st Marine Division left.
Guadalcanal,
I think he got in as a replacement probably, and he was on Cape Gloucester, and he, you know, I knew Art, not well, but when I knew him, he was having, some memory issues, because he probably was 91.
Right.
But, you know, he talked about Cape Gloucester as being one of the most miserable places on the planet, because it was wet, and, just really wet. And then, you know, there was the combat there. And then, you know, going through Peleliu, which in some ways may have been the worst battle the Marines were in. I don't know.
It's right. Like, now, you read, I think the series Pacific does, tries to show the horrible conditions under which those guys, not just conditions, but the terrain, and really, the Japanese changing their tactics and not coming down to the beach with the bonsai attack. So this thing's over, you know, in less than a week, but digging in and making you come root them out. And then just the nature of the terrain on Peleliu lent itself to just their in close fighting. And that series, I think, does, as well as Sledge's book. You read that, you're just wow. And to think that he went through Cape Gloucester, Peleliu, and then Okinawa, the cherry on top. Holy smokes! And then he gets, so he's awarded the Medal of Honor. He gets out of the Marine Corps, and then for a while, yes.
Right.
And then what happened?
And I think he went into the Army for a little while, maybe. And he got out, and then he went back in the Marine Corps. He was an officer. He was stationed at Guantanamo, and there was a guy there who was a bus driver, a Cuban national, who was a spy, and they got into a scuffle, and Art terminated him and was concerned about being handed over to the Cubans and tried in their system. So he and another guy, I believe, hid the body, but they got found out. And so he was asked to leave the Marine Corps.
Yeah, if you can imagine that, he was asked to, after that incident of, you know, according to the statements, you know, he had detained this guy who was accused of being a spy. He said the guy went for his weapon and he shot and killed him. Then they went out and they buried the body, right? And then he's asked to leave the Marine Corps. That's
right.
That's not exactly the way I think that would probably be handled these days, but certainly handled a little bit on the down low in a different era in our world.
Right. And so then, you know, after that he was in the Army. He told me that he would, you know, he was airborne, that he jumped. I think he got out of the military in 1984, and then he was the regional director of the VA up here in this part of the world, I believe, until he retired. So,
but a long, interesting life. Now, are you doing a project on Art?
No, we have interviewed his wife, Sally.
Okay.
About what it's like to be the wife of a combat veteran for our current project, which is a film about wives of combat veterans. We interviewed her and a Japanese American woman whose husband, both her and her husband were interred at the beginning of World War II, and he got out and went to Italy and France as a member of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team.
Right.
We've interviewed a woman whose husband was in the Navy, and when the Marines were coming down from Joseon, he volunteered to go help bring them down and suffered PTSD related events and stuff helping the Marines. Interviewed a Vietnam veteran's wife. He was actually a corpsman at Quezon. And we've interviewed two women whose husbands were in Iraq and Afghanistan. So
that's the project. Are you still continuing the interviews, or are you done with the interviews?
Yeah, we're stopped because it's fundraising time.
Okay. It does cost money. The my guest is a former Marine Corporal, Ken Rogers. And he's turned himself into a documentary maker, and always interesting guest to have on. The one of the things that's happened to me doing this show is I'll do pieces, and you know, then that stuff goes onto the internet, and it stays around as long as it's on the server, right? And so forever. I mean, if you keep that stuff up, and people will listen to stuff I did, and then they'll a while ago, and they'll email me about it. I just had an experience yesterday about an interview I did with an Army veteran who was at Normandy, and he's a Ranger and went up Point du Hoc. His great, or I want to say his something like his great grandnephew or something like that, you know, so a distant relative, wrote me this letter saying, thank you very much for doing the interview and playing that. You know, we learned things about him through that, you know, he's never even opened up to us about it. I'm wondering, have you had similar experiences with the Quezon documentary? People see it and then they contact you afterwards and to either send you something or to want to talk to you about it?
Yes. Actually, it happened to me when we were making the film. We had the film basically made, and we went to George Lucas's location in Marin County, California to mix the sound, and my daughter and her husband lived in San Francisco at the time, and we invited them to come up while we mixed the film, and they sat there, and she had no idea what I had experienced. I think it, you know, I mean, it, she told my wife, thank you. And then later that year, we screened it in my hometown, and my son came, and it was the same experience for him. So, I mean, yes, you know, people tell me later, now I understand my dad. I hear that a lot.
Right. In a way I didn't before. I had no idea.
Yeah, it happens for people whose parents were my parents' age. You know, my dad was a bombardier in World War II, and now I understand why he was the way he was, and I hear that kind of stuff a lot.
Interesting. Education. Well, and again, I think a lot of the treatment, you know, and one of the things I enjoy about your documentary is the rawness of it. It's just these guys telling their story. Right. And I think the audio, and in particular, the constant audio of the sounds of caisson, which would have been incoming rounds and also outgoing. But that it's disturbing as you watch it. And I think for people that have lived with people who have gone through these things. I think it's a, you know, you open up a window in a way that a lot of people, you know, a lot of people never see opened or get the glimpse inside. And I'm sure it's helpful to them to come to grips with, you know, like you said, God, now I understand. I had no idea, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it's like it is, unless I think how it works for people like us. You're not going to talk about it to somebody because they're not going to be able to understand what you're talking about. I mean, I can't go to my kids and explain to them the absolute terror of taking 1,500 rounds of incoming in a day. I mean, you can't explain that, you know, and so people don't talk about it because nobody's going to, you'll understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But, you know, somebody else isn't that hasn't had the experience of having the shit scared out of them, yeah. Not just for 10 seconds because somebody swerved on the road,
right.
But for hours. You know, I mean, it's just the power of that experience is so frightening that people don't understand it. I mean, unless you've been through it.
You know,
so you don't talk about it.
It's almost like the nerve that thank you for your service touches when you don't think they mean it. It's a sacred place inside of you because what you saw there was so incredible and really, the courage and the selflessness. I mean, Howard Corman, who, and medic, Army medics, how are they ever right in the head? It's not like an EMT saves and works on people he doesn't or she doesn't know. Okay, and only in a freak accident do they tend to people that they know. The lot of a corpsman and a medic is to treat his friends, his buddies, who may or may not be dying in front of him and may be begging him, please don't let me die.
Right.
And how do they, I don't know how they're ever right in the head, period, after that experience. You know, they deserve their own little spot in heaven or someplace, because that is as rough as it gets. I remember I was in Iraq and, you know, and you're around people and you're around death and, yeah, you know, and it sticks in your head. And I remember being in a place called HIT as I went with General Kelly, who's now the Secretary of Homeland Defense. We were heading out to the border because there had been a pretty large battle, I want to say in April of 2004, in a city called Husseva in Al-Qaim. A Marine captain was killed out there. They had a pretty big fight, so he wanted to check it out, and he took me with him. And as we stopped and hit and we spent the night there, there was a this bag of stuff that had been shipped from the United States, and there was a dog tag, and on the dog tag there was this inscription, and it was a biblical inscription, and I'm not the greatest biblical guy, in spite of my Catholic upbringing, but it said words to the effect, "Be not terrified, for the Lord." Right, and then I think it's Joshua, and it's that quote about fear not, as you walk through the valley of death, blah 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 blah.
Yeah, right.
But the word terrified was in there, and I remember when I read it. So I'm just rifling through. There's toothbrushes, there's toothpaste, there's socks, there's chapstick, there's hard candy. There's just little containers of dog tag looking things. So I pick one up and I read it. And when I read the word terrified, I said, "Oh, that's me," right? And I put it on my dog tags, and I've had it there ever since. And I just gave it to my youngest son, who's out in the Pacific right now. And I looked at him, and I said, "I hope you'll never understand what this really means." I said, "But it was good luck for me, so I want it back." And he just smiled, and he said, "All right." I said, "But you got to wear it. If you don't wear it, I'm not giving you up because it's sacred to me." And he said, "I'll wear it." And he said, "Here, you can have one of mine." So he gave me one of his dog tags, and it's on my dog tag right now. But you know what? Those kind of words, the word terrified is what you're talking about. And how you read it, and you're like, "Oh yeah, that's me. That's me. I know what that is."
But I know what that word means.
But I will say this, Ken. I think your documentary is a little glimpse into that world of what it is to be terrified. And even for me, when you talk about what do you guys call that patrol that went out and got destroyed?
Ghost Patrol.
The Ghost Patrol. And how many Marines and sailors were killed?
27.
When you talk about a number like that, you know, that's a huge number to think that those guys went out and didn't come back. I mean, that makes a dent on, I think, everybody. That's a big number. That's a lot of Marines and sailors that don't come back in after they go out on a quote unquote patrol. And so I think your documentary is great in that it's disturbing, it's raw enough, it's not tasteless either. It's all done in the context of your project, but I think it's good in that it's disturbing. It makes people think, and I think that's a good thing. What's been the most?
Oh, thank you.
I'm a fan. What's been the most unique thing that's happened to you in the aftermath of making? Bravo?
Oh man, that's a good question. You know, I think the thing that really keeps settling on me is last year we went back to Quantico to get an award from the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation for the film, and while we were there I got a telephone call from some captain over at the basic school who his name was Joe Albano. Who was in charge of the scouting and patrolling course. And I knew that they had been studying the Ghost Patrol as a problem for the course. And I knew that. And so he told me that he was one of the officers that was involved with this, and there were a number of them. He invited me and my wife and Mike O'Hara, who's in the film, and who was with us, to come over and chat with him. And so we went over to the basic school, and we met the colonel. I don't remember his name. Workman, I believe was his name.
Workman.
Christian Workman. And which was, you know, he said, "I wish I could stay here, but my daughter's going to the prom tonight." And we met with four guys, and they were using our film as a
case study
tool in this class. And the thing that was really a surprise to me at the time, and it's really sunk in, is that it was more about showing the men in the film talking about the human aspects of combat, and then they would ask their students in the course of this class, you know, you've just lost three men, and what are you going to do? And if, you know, if they couldn't answer, you just lost two more, this kind of thing. And, and then they would use these personal moments from these men as examples of this. These people are real people. Your troops are real people.
It's called the case method. And they've embraced it at the basic school, and I think they're in the process of exporting it. But it's better than some theoretical, you know, a little map with units on it. The personal aspect of, especially as a leader, so from corporal to, you know, general, what now, lieutenant? You know, what now, corporal? But when when it's real and it has a face and it has a real outcome, I think it's certainly, I know having used it, it's certainly much more, it lends itself to a lot more learning going on than it is from some, you know, Alpha Company 1-1 is here doing this, blah, 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 blah. And so, wow. So you said you spent the afternoon with them going over it?
Yeah, we spent the afternoon with them. They gave us a short course in it. And then we went to the club there with them. I don't remember the name of the place, but
Hawk.
Yeah. And sat around and chatted with them. And got to see them as human beings. You know, I mean, all these guys were combat veterans of the crap in the Middle East, and they understood what the hell we were talking about. So, you know, it was profound for me. So.
Well, that's cool. All right, update us, final question for you today. What, you're looking for more money, but, when do you anticipate, your next project being out?
Don't know. We want it to be out by the end of next year.
Okay.
So we're writing grants, and we've got 10 women that are excited about getting interviewed, but man, it costs a lot of money. So
yeah. All right. All right. First of all, I always enjoy these conversations. Just so you know, and I love having you on. You have a common sense way of articulating these very, very complex emotions. And like I said, I'm a huge fan of your work. So where do people, for people that have never seen Bravo, how do people get a copy of it?
You can go to www.bravotheproject.com, and there's a page there about, I think it's called Store, and they can find a copy of it there. Or you can go there and see where we're going to be screening in the future, because we are still going out screening the film. We're probably going to be in Santa Fe this fall, which is always a good place to be in the fall. And probably going to be screening it here locally at the War Hawk Air Museum sometime next year, in conjunction with the 50th anniversary of the Siege of Quezon. So,
wow. Does that seem hardly possible, 50 years?
No, it does not. Of course, you know, when you get to be my, I'm 70, okay? Right. So when you get to be my age, it's one of those things that you think you're still in your 20s, man.
What happened?
What happened?
Who are all these old people, man? What happened?
Really?
Yeah. All right. Well, Ken, first of all, I appreciate you doing this. And like I said, I always enjoy our conversations, whether we're talking current events or Quezon or Marine stuff or anything. So thank you for coming on and doing this today.
Oh, appreciate it. Always enjoy talking to you, Mac. So you're doing a good thing here, man. So.
Well, I love doing it. It's obviously opened a door that has allowed me to cross paths with you and a whole lot of guys like you. So I have a cool job. Anyway, all right, man. Have a good day. Thanks.
Yes, sir. Semper Fi.
Semper Fidelis. That is Ken Rogers here. He is a cool dude, man. He is a cool dude, and I love having him on the program. And again, if you haven't seen it, it's called Bravo! Common Men, Uncommon Valor. Wait till you're alone one day, put it on a good video system. It's a DVD, obviously, that has a good sound system, and turn the sound system up a little bit. All right, and your pets will take off after very short order. I know Jack did. I had to go looking for him. He was under the bed. He's not a fan of Kason. Anyway, we're going to take a break. The Gunner's going to join us next on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio right here on your home for All Marine Radio, the All Warrior Radio Network. Don't touch that dial.